For many of us, we go into health professions to be helpers to others in need. Our identity and life experiences have shaped our gifts into caring for our community. But when illness becomes part of our own family story, how do you find the balance in the duality of roles? Welcome to Wondercast, a community collaborative podcast supporting families navigating the complexities of chronic illness and injury. Wondercast is supported by the generous sponsorship of Texas Oncology. Texas Oncology, more breakthroughs, more victories, experts in cancer care. Today, we are joined by Christy Apple, palliative care nurse practitioner and Wonders and Worries client family. Join us as we discuss balancing professional life with personal illness, caring for others while caring for ourselves as well. This is Christy.
Hi, I'm Christy Apple. I am a recipient, I suppose you would say, my children are recipients of services through Wonders and Worries. Been really beneficial to them. And I just happen to work in a medical field where I have conversations every day with people who have advanced diseases like cancer and discovered in Wonders and Worries during one of my trips to annual assembly for hospice and palliative medicine. They come to our conference every year and I met them in the exhibit hall and it was great because they were there this year too. And I got to hug them and say, hey, you guys have helped my kids so much. Thank you.
That's so awesome.
I got a picture with them when we were there and I was like, can you guys take a picture of me behind the desk with all this stuff?
That's so fun. They're really incredible ladies. Yes,
they really are. And I had no idea that that was like a service. We always talk about like talking with patients and their families and trying to find services for people's children who are young and have cancer. You know, it was just like light bulb, like we're going through this too. Like we could benefit from this.
I'm so glad that it's worked out for them. You're comfortable sharing a little bit about your profession. We'll start there.
Okay. So I have worked as a palliative nurse practitioner in various settings for the last 5 years. I finished graduate school in 2019. My husband is active duty military and had already relocated to Atlanta for work. And so I relocated here and it was, you know, really, I established myself here with the hospice and palliative community. I did inpatient hospice, inpatient and palliative nursing as a nurse case manager, and also home-based palliative care, and then really got into where I intended to be, which was inpatient palliative care in the hospital setting and in the acute care setting. My day consists of mostly having difficult conversations with people all day long about their illness and what it means and what the future looks like and what their goals and treatment preferences are and what kind of challenges they're anticipating going through and overcoming. We also do a lot of symptoms management for people who have cancer and are doing cancer therapy. And we also provide end-of-life care for people in the hospital who can't make it home to hospice. You know, I get to have these conversations with people all day long, but not with children. And I think a lot of people are like, oh, children are just tiny adults. No, no, they are not.
No, it's so different. And you're right. You have this skill set, which I'm sure even if you doubted yourself, which hopefully you didn't, you have the words. It's just rephrasing and finding new ways to deliver that information.
Yeah. And, you know, I think one of the important questions that we ask people all the time is like, how much do you want to know about your illness? And I think that while most adults have an understanding of how much they want to know the details, which usually is everything, most people want to be well informed. There's a small percentage of people who say, oh, I don't want to know anything. Just don't tell me. But with kids, I think kids don't really have like the world exposure and knowledge to really understand, well, how much do I want to know? And they're such a special population because they're changing developmentally, emotionally, socially so quickly that you really have to have an understanding of like where they're at in that lifespan process. Like I have experience as a parent in, but not as a professional. Having somebody help really assess that has been really helpful.
Do you want to share a little bit about your illness journey that has led you guys through Wonders and Worries?
Absolutely. Initially, my ex-husband had been visiting the kids here in Atlanta. Usually they fly out there. They're a little older now, so they can fly with the sitter service through the airlines, but he had came to visit here and had a spot on his leg. And it was a spot that I knew he's had his whole life that they were keeping an eye on because it was suspicious. And it looked totally different. And I was like, go and get this looked at. Like, what is going on with the spot? And he said, I don't know. It's hurting. It's itching. Sure enough, he had it tested, biopsied. It was positive for melanoma, stage 2C. So he had it surgically removed. It was a very deep wound. Then he had to go in and have lymph node dissection, which caused his leg to have a lot of swelling. So he's really struggled with, you know, movements, with body image. Like most people who have cancer, one of those unspoken things that we don't talk about, most people with cancer struggle with some sort of anxiety and depression. And all of those things have been really tough for him. Him and I are fortunate enough to co-parent and have a kind of relationship where we're very open with one another. We're friends. Like, and when he comes to visit the kids here, he stays with us. We just try to do the best we can to just be good people for our kids and put our differences aside for them. So, you know, we're fortunate in that area, but with the ongoing challenge of him being far away, having limited access to services. I mean, he is in Houston, which has some of the best cancer treatment centers in the world, but he doesn't have great insurance, unfortunately. And he has had to continue to work through this whole thing. Treatment, surgeries, recurrence, more treatment, despite how tired he feels, to keep his insurance. And I think that that's been a tough thing. It's been difficult for the kids. It's been difficult for me. Being responsible, feeling responsible not only for the kids' future and kind of stressing and worrying about like how he's doing for their sake, but also for his sake, because I care about him as a human being. You know, I do. I think the hardest thing has been like being so far away and him not having all of the knowledge that I have. It's been really, really difficult. The kids go there to visit him for pretty much all of their breaks. They're there for Christmas break, spring break, Thanksgiving, summer, for as long as they can. Gone through so many changes with the kids growing up. I mean, we've been going through this for a few years now. He's still undergoing immunotherapy and has had spread, unfortunately. His whole right lower leg has lesions all over it. And, you know, he's on second line therapy right now. And it's tough. It's scary knowing what I know. It's scary knowing that he could potentially be getting better care somewhere else, but can't.
Yeah, that's hard.
Yeah.
Now you have this knowledge base. Do you feel like that has made it extra anxiety inducing for you because it's like you almost know so much?
All the time, in multiple ways. I think that I would have different words and advocacy for myself or in person, questions to ask. And I've tried to prepare him as much as possible. I've given him some resources of like apps that he can use on like, how do I prepare for my next meeting? And I think that he's stretched thin right now and he's doing the best he can. I can't push him to do any more than that. There's part of me that's like, oh, we could be doing so much more right now. You know, we could be talking and getting second opinions and having, you know, a little bit more aggressive treatment. But I just don't think that he has it in him. And I have to like limit myself on how much I try to push him because I know that it's going to be too much for him. And you know, what I can handle as a human being is not going to be the same as what he can handle. And I think having my experience as a palliative provider to understand that is good because it helps me set boundaries for myself. But two, it's also very frustrating because this is the other side of it, is that like I get consults all the time for patients who have advanced melanoma and maybe they've reached the end of their illness trajectory or they've run out of treatment options. They're not responding to treatment anymore. And they just have pain and symptoms management and end of life needs. And it scares me. I worry that that day could come. I don't know when. And all I can do is just, you know, kind of put it on the back burner and just do the best I can to support him and, you know, be there for him in the ways that he wants me to be and try not to overstep my boundaries. That's really hard.
I was going to say one thing that I am just so impressed, and maybe I don't know you well, maybe this is just you as a human, but maybe this is your clinician skills coming into play too. The listening to boundaries, that is incredible. The fact that you're able to say like, oh, if this was me, this is what I would do. If this was my kid, this is what I would be doing.
Yeah.
But you are a very capable adult and we're not married. I'm not your spouse. Extra hard layer, I feel like.
I mean, there's so many different levels of complication to it that I think it's been the most challenging part of it for me. I'm fortunate that I have a ton of support here. You know, every time I get like a new resource or something that might help, I just kind of pass it along to him. And I'm like, hey, here's something you can check out if you need to. And if there's anything I can do legwork wise for him to just kind of make it a little easier, I will. Being surrounded by death and illness on a daily basis always brings to the forefront of my mind how important it is to just like live every day and do the best you can. And, you know, try not to just spend your life suffering no matter what your circumstances are.
We do have a lot of clinical providers that are part of our listening audience. We talk about compassion fatigue and we talk about duality of roles. You know so much, but you're also trying so hard to maintain that boundary. And you said yourself, you have a great support system. Do you have any advice for anyone who maybe is a physician or a nurse practitioner or child life specialist who are basically in the medical know, but are trying very hard to not be the one in the know about everything?
One, I think we all need therapy. Every single one of us.
Yes.
If you work in a helping profession and you have any kind of distress, like, I can't emphasize enough like how much therapy for myself has been helpful. And I know that that's a hard thing to say because not everybody has access to therapy. But I think doing whatever you can to get that kind of help, whether it be in the form of like a support group or, you know, a decompressive group of people that you hang out with and you can talk about these things together, or having that one-on-one is really, really important. And I also can't emphasize enough like how important taking care of ourselves is and boundaries. And I think that's one of the places where I really, really learn boundaries, not only in my own like personal life, but my professional life as well. Because I have been in a place like when I was a new palliative provider and I just overdid it. I just poured way too much of myself into my work and came out the other end just exhausted, you know, unable to control my own emotions.
Not your best self.
Yeah, just dysregulated. And I've gotten to a point now where like, I know that I can't help everybody. I know that not everybody is going to have the outcome that I hope for them. And some of that is just experience. And I think giving yourself space, if you're a newer provider in this field or, you know, working closely with people who have these kinds of illnesses, that like just giving yourself that space of like, it's going to feel bad and weird for a while. And some of this stuff is going to make me feel really uncomfortable, but that's part of it. And so like the acceptance, one of the things that really helped me early on in my career was doing a lot of reflective journaling. Like if I have a situation in my head that I'm just ruminating on, it's just playing over and over in my head, what could I have done different? I'm in the shower, like talking through it, like can't get it out of my brain because it's just clearly something that's caused distress for me. Putting on a paper and then just kind of writing through the different aspects of it. Like, you know, what went right? What went well? What went bad? What could I have done different? And then also writing down things like, here are things that I have no control over. Here are the things that I have control over. And it's usually stuff that relates specifically to me and not to the situation at all. And that is impossible to look away from in our profession because we all know that healthcare is fragmented and we all know that access to care is not what it should be. We all know that the cost of healthcare isn't what it should be. And so healthcare comes with inherent secondary trauma. And if we don't acknowledge that and just accept some of it, change what we can, work towards what we can, use energy that we have towards advocacy when we can, but learn how to shut it off and walk away and just do things that are just good and healthy for you. You just have to write through it, think through it, whatever your process is. Some people run. I'm not a runner. I do pottery.
Which is amazing.
Very mindful, very like, you know, that dopamine, serotonin reaction that you get from making something with your hands. You know, you just have to find your spot where you can find peace because this world is not good. There's a lot of things that are really bad and we just have to focus on what is good.
As I'm thinking for the layer of divorce and separation and living states away is definitely, I feel like, an added layer of hard. But even for people who are, maybe it's your partner, even your adult child that has an illness, you still have to honor their way of approaching this, much like you would if you were in a divorced relationship. They are their own person. And I feel like that onus of wanting to take control over someone's illness, especially when you know so much and you're right about a lot of what you know, and you know you were drawn to that profession specifically because you have a desire to help. And so I feel like that is what pulls us that direction because we want to help. Sometimes it's hard to turn that off and realize the best help that we're actually giving is helping this person have their own voice.
What a strange dichotomy. I mean, it's very like, it's one way or the other. It's usually not in between either. It's very much like I can help this person or I just need to walk away. Sometimes you can only do one or the other. You know, I've had multiple patients that I've seen, you know, coming in with this idea of like, oh, I reviewed their case and I think that this and this and this could help. But then when you start talking to them, you're just like, all right, I'm throwing all that out the window. None of that's going to help because this person's not in a place where they can even acknowledge, you know, take care of your nausea. And we're just gonna let all that go for now. Maybe down the road. I mean.
But I think that skill set is what grows some of the very best advocates and listeners, right? Because I just know with my experience with palliative and all the people I've spoken with who've worked in palliative, you're gifted this opportunity to see beyond the early phases of illness. Anyone who's in palliative, they're not in the early phases of their illness. For many of them, they're either facing the kind of the end of their care or they're facing this chronic illness that they need help managing some symptoms. I think your ability to get to reality is a lot easier in the palliative care because you remove all the fluff, right?
Yeah. Yeah. And I think that's why this, even being in this field, when people are like, your profession's so hard, for me, I think it's easier in a lot of ways.
I think so too. Because I mean, it's hard, big feelings, but I would rather be dealing in the real stuff, like the stuff that matters at the end of the day, which is what majority of your patients are at, than in the stuff that doesn't matter. I feel, I don't know. It's just everyone has their own calling, I guess.
I think anybody who's done CPR on a 95-year-old with end-stage cancer in the emergency department can agree with that.
Yes.
Like you know what your brand of heart is and what it isn't.
Now, also kind of looking at your kids, because this illness has been something that has continued to transform throughout childhood. Very likely their developmental stages have changed. How have you seen their understanding of illness transform over their ages?
I think, you know, early on, they had no idea like that anything was really going on with their dad, that was serious. And you know, they were like, yeah, dad had surgery. And that's pretty much, if you ask them about it, that's what they could have told you was that their dad had surgery and he's got a big wound on his leg. But they didn't really understand like where that came from, what it meant. And, you know, I think a lot of people are of the mindset of like sheltering their children and not telling them things. And, you know, I have found that to be very detrimental to children, especially when things go really bad later on and they're like, well, what the heck? Dad was fine and now he's not and now he's dying and like they can't wrap their little heads around it. Like I said, it's been like 3 years that we've been dealing with this and my children are 10 and 12 now. And so we're talking about like hitting puberty, all of the big major changes. My 10-year-old was diagnosed with autism when she was 8 years old during the process of all this, which helped us to really realize, oh, like maybe her emotional understanding of things is not going to be the same as somebody her age, which has been the fact. She relates to children much younger than herself. So her developmental stage was maybe not exactly the same as somebody else her age. And then my 12-year-old, who is very just, I mean, she's open about the world. She sees things in ways that I saw them when I was 18. And, you know, not because she's been overexposed to things, but just because she has a very curious mind. And I know from my own personal experience and then also just from learning that like when kids are like that, you're not going to suppress them from knowledge. They're going to find it some way or another. They have access to, you know, these little devices that they carry around that basically have all the knowledge of the world in them. As much as you limit their exposure to that, they're going to find things. You know, things have changed so much and you know, my 12-year-old, you know, understanding her personal self, her social self, and now like she's coming into that prepubescent, like discovering her sexual self and like all of those things, as much as we want to be like as parents, like, oh no, they're too young for that. No, they're not. They're doing those things whether you like it or not. And you know, it's just been really, really good to have the openness with them, the understanding, to be able to say the word cancer around them without them just like melting down and crying. Because, you know, when you hear cancer on TV, everybody's sad and bad things are happening and somebody's dying. And you know, like that's not necessarily what it means, that it's a trajectory and not just like a, this is what happens and then it ends. And I think that just understanding that helps decrease their anxiety so much because they are very aware kids.
Even if they were closer in age, even if they were, you know, 9 and 8 at the time of diagnosis, they're such individual learners. You have one that is incredibly curious. You have one that maybe doesn't want all that information. And just recognizing that that changes over the time, I think that's important for our listeners to recognize. It's not just looking at the ages of your kids, but looking at your individual kid. You might have a kid that is on the spectrum, that does have a different emotional intelligence than they maybe have an understanding of the word cancer. So it's just kind of seeking those tools to help the individual child versus just helping where they should be based on a piece of paper that says, oh, they're 9 years old or oh, they're 7 years old. Yeah.
That was one of the things that was really wonderful about working with Danielle in Houston too, is I was able to tell her like, hey, like, here's what we know about Elsie's diagnosis. And we know that, you know, developmentally, you know, while intelligent wise, she's like doing like 10th grade math, she is emotionally very immature and needs a little bit of help in that area. Whereas Noelle is just kind of like, yeah, let's talk about everything. Come on, let's do it. My kids are just really different. So she's been fantastic with meeting their individual needs, really, you know, exploring things in different ways. And when the kids came home from Houston for the summer and they were here, and then the package from Amazon arrived with like the little goodies in and little things that they were going to do together, I was like, this is incredible. It has been cool. Like just seeing like how my younger daughter was able to tell me like, we got these jars out and we did this little activity and this is what I understood from it. And I'm like, that's really profound. Like I wouldn't have thought that.
Do you want to touch on what's going on in your own personal medical journey?
Yes. I love talking about it. It's not something that we talk about it enough. It needs to be talked about more. And, you know, for the simple fact that like people, when I tell people like, hey, I just underwent a mastectomy, they're like, oh, I'm so sorry that you have cancer. I'm like, no. I'm a previvor. I have prevented myself from getting cancer. And, you know, of course, made famous by some celebrities and, you know, you can never tell that they underwent anything. Whereas, you know, that's not usually the case. I love to share it because I think that more women need to know that this is an option. Yeah. So my mom actually was diagnosed with cancer when she was 39. She had breast cancer and she underwent lumpectomies and chemotherapy, radiation, tamoxifen therapy, and then, you know, later on had some reconstruction. And her sister then, a few years down the road, got breast cancer and died from it. And while we don't have BRCA, or one of the big like identifiable genetic factors, we do have, you know, what's called a mosaic risk factor pattern that is associated with a higher risk of breast cancer in women. Knowing that, I started getting my mammograms when I was young and had some spots they've been keeping an eye on. And lo and behold, this last year when I went to have my mammogram, there were changes that were pretty obvious. I could actually feel them at this point. I knew something was up. I was a little late on my mammo this time around. You know, this has happened before and I didn't really think a whole lot of it, but I had the biopsy and sure enough, I had atypical hyperplasia, which that alone increases your risk of breast cancer substantially. So with my combined risk factors, it was determined that my lifetime risk for breast cancer was 50%. And I was not playing around at this point. Like, my ex-husband has cancer, you know, my mom, her sister, our history. I'm like, take them off. And my breast surgeon said that that was actually her recommendation anyways. And some women don't want to go through that. They choose to wait and monitor. And I said, absolutely not, take them off. It wasn't even a difficult decision for me to make. It was like, this is what I'm doing. Before I even got to that point, I think some of that was the palliative provider in me being like, I'm not going to be one of those women who's 45 years old and said, yeah, I'll wait. And then it shows up in my brain and then I die. And like, I'm just not doing that. Having the bilateral mastectomy reduced my risk of breast cancer to less than the general population. I never have to have a mammogram again. It's an annual ultrasound. Woo, woo. Like, how many ways can you talk me out of it? Like,
I know.
So I had surgery back in September. I had tissue expanders for a few months. And then last week, I had the completion of my reconstructive surgery. And so now I'm done. Not having any complications. I'm doing really well. I'm off work right now, taking a little time for myself to just kind of rest and recuperate, and going back to work next week. Feeling really good, actually. Hopefully they'll clear me to exercise again soon. It was cool because, like, when we were talking to the kids about it, they were like, oh, this is no big deal. You're having a surgery and you don't have cancer. It's to prevent cancer. And they were completely chill about it. And they've been like that this whole time.
I know. Oftentimes we worry about compacting stress and trauma for our kids. Actually, they've had this exposure already that now they already have those tools. So they're able to have some of these conversations that you're going to think might freak them out. But actually, they're like, oh, cool. We know all about that.
Like the day that I came home from surgery, they were like, Mom, can you do this? And I'm like, I'm a little drowsy right now. So no, you know, and normally they're pretty aware. So, I mean, they just knew that it wasn't going to be a scary thing. And even with their dad now, I think that they're doing well. Like they're there, you know, his leg doesn't look good. He's having a hard time with mobility. I think he's really struggling emotionally right now. And they're just like, yeah, it's okay. They're finding ways to compensate and to help him and to help themselves while they're there.
I want to be mindful of your time. Is there anything I failed to mention or anything for our listening audience that you want to share?
I could stay on here all day and talk. I don't have anything else going on.
I'm trying to think if there's anything maybe for somebody who is trying to do all the things, right? They're trying to juggle being a professional. They're trying to juggle their own medical self-care needs and support either a spouse or a partner or a co-parent, something else. Do you have any advice for them in terms of how to not get stuck in that well?
Yeah. I have gotten really good this year about telling people no. I was on some committees. I was doing a lot of extra stuff that I feel really passionate about. And I knew that it was time for me to step back and just not. And to be okay with letting myself have some lazy days and some rest days where, you know, a lot of medical professionals are really high functioning, really high performing, high output people. And we thrive in being like in this space where we want to be like overachievers because it's kind of like ingrained in us. I think like in order to go into a medical field, there's a part of you that is really like, I have to be the best I can absolutely be in order to do this. And I think we're all kind of neurotic like that. And I think just being able to say no and to take back time for yourself and rest and not do things. You know, my house is a disaster right now. Normally it's spotless. I don't care because that's just where I'm at right now. I just need to take some time to just let things go and come back to them when I have more energy, when I have the physical ability to do those things and the emotional ability. I mean, going back to work after mastectomy, I think for the first 3 weeks, I was so tired. Still, because it was a really intense surgery. I mean, it was hard to recover from that. I'm still having nerve pain and, you know, not sleeping well and, you know, wearing a compression garment all the time. I mean, it was awful. And I knew I had to go to bed early. I knew that we were going to be ordering takeout because there was just too many nights where we just didn't have the energy to cook and do a lot of stuff. I'm paying somebody to do the yard right now. Like there are things that you just have to let go. Sometimes you got to get creative with that because sometimes you can't let them go. I can't let cat hair get out of control in my house because I have a child with allergies. So that's something that I employ help for if I can. But there's just things that you just have to let go and you have to learn to just relax and take time to just be like, it's okay for me to not always be productive. Because I think that there's a lot of guilt in our society about not being productive all the time. When you're not being productive, what are you doing with yourself? You're there's something wrong with you. You're bed rotting. You're useless. And like we internalize that, and we have to change that narrative because leisure and relaxation, you know, sitting on the front porch in a rocking chair with some lemonade used to be something that people did to promote their longevity and their recuperation after having worked really hard for a really long period of time. And you know, we need to get back to some of that.
Thank you for tuning in to our podcast today. Please subscribe and continue to check back as our content is ever evolving. For questions or specific content-related requests, please send an email to podcast@wondersandworries.org.